Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I am Kemper Donovan, and on this episode, I will not be discussing a written text. I have something much more special in store for you, dear listeners. I will start rather circuitously with a hypothetical I used to like to amuse myself with when I was younger. If you could go anywhere in time, when would you go and why? I had a very specific answer to this that I came up with at some point in my teenaged years. This answer is still featured in the Twitter bio for my personal Twitter account, which I never tweet from or use. So don't go to it. Please do go to the podcast's Twitter account at All About the Dame. In any case, my specific answer was that I would travel back in time to the year 1848. That's right. I was so obsessed with Victorian literature that I loved the idea of being able to go back in time to a period when so much was about to happen. There was so much exciting stuff in store for those Victorians in 1848. They had over 50 years to go of the Victorian era, which did not end technically until Queen Victoria's death in 1901. So first off, I just liked the idea of traveling back to the early to mid Victorian period. The late Victorian era always slightly depresses me for the very simple reason that it means the Victorian age is drawing to a close. So there's that. But also in 1848, so much great literature was on the immediate horizon. David Copperfield would come out just 1 year later. Dickens had not yet written A Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations. Those would appear later in his career. Those are all great favorites of mine. Wilkie Collins, who was one of my very favorite authors in any age, that will come as no surprise to longtime listeners of this podcast. I have brought up Wilkie Collins before. He had his entire oeuvre in front of him, in fact. He would begin publishing in 1850, and his career would flourish, of course, with The Woman in White, published in 1860, and The Moonstone, published in 1868. I love me some Wilkie Collins. Also, just 1 year before, in 1847, Jane Eyre, one of my very favorite novels, had come out, along with Wuthering Heights. But of course, never forget that those two novels were published at the same time. And so was Agnes Grey. We shall not forget poor Anne Bronte. Also, in 3 short years, the Great Exhibition would happen in 1851. This is when the Crystal Palace was built in Hyde Park in London. I am a huge fan of the Crystal Palace. I could go on and on here, as you can probably tell. I just really love the notion of traveling back in time to 1848 and seeing things as they were on the ground in and around England. An alternate answer, and one that I definitely remember giving from time to time, is that I would love to travel back in time to Shakespeare's day, and specifically to the Globe Theater, to see one of his plays performed as originally intended. Either Measure for Measure or The Winter's Tale, probably. I'm a fan of the problem plays in particular. But surely now, if I were to engage in this same exercise, given how much time and passion I've devoted to the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie, surely I would have to answer that if I could go back in time, I would love to meet Agatha Christie in the flesh, in real life, or IRL, as the kids say. What a joy that would be. And in this episode, I am so thrilled to inform you, I am going to attempt to do just that. That's right. I am going to bring you the stories of 3 different people in the world today who did meet Agatha Christie IRL. And through their words, I am going to get to convey to you what it was like to bask in the presence of our beloved author. I am so excited to be doing this. Yes, this is a different kind of an episode, but I think you're really going to enjoy it. All right, first up, we have Yasuo Sudo. Now, I went into some detail about Mr. Pseudo in my episode titled It's Raining Rankings, Hallelujah, or to put it another way,
It's Raining
Rankings,
Hallelujah.
By the way, quick tangent here, but if you have not seen the original music video for It's Raining Men, please do yourself a favor and go on YouTube and check it out. It is the most ludicrous, kitschy, entertaining, and yet oddly empowering thing I've ever seen. Digression over. Mr. Pseudo is a scholar of Agatha Christie from Japan, and he is a super fan who actually corresponded with and visited Agatha Christie late in her career. So he was kind enough to share the Japanese fan club's rankings grid of all of Christie's novels, which I talked about at great length on this previous episode. But while I was corresponding with Mr. Pseudo, I asked him a question. And in all honesty, it wasn't an especially original question. I didn't even really expect him to answer it because he was already doing so much for me by sharing that grid. But Mr. Pseudo did answer my question. And with the help of the A++ All About Agatha listener who first put me in touch with Mr. Pseudo, I was able to read his response in English. This listener translated Mr. Pseudo's answer from Japanese to English, for which I am eternally grateful. And here it is. So first, he starts by restating my question. Question from Mr. Kemper Donovan. Since you corresponded with Agatha Christie and then met her, what was the most surprising thing you learned about her as a person, as opposed to the writer you got to know through her books? So that's the question. It's okay. And now Mr. Pseudo continues, my answer. Before answering, I would like to describe my situation at that time and how I was invited. This is because what surprised me might not be understood without this premise. And then he has a series of numbered sections. This is a very detailed answer. It's so lovely. So, section one, the first letter to Ms. Christie. I wrote this letter around September 1966. At that time, I was a master's student studying tape recorders, but I was already on track to finish my master's thesis, so I made good use of the remaining time and read through many mystery works that used tape recorders, and I came up with the idea of writing a playful paper, such as tape recorders and detective novels, while I was at it. And I immediately had the following question, and I will pause for a moment to note that this is slightly spoilery as to the murder of Roger Ackroyd, so fast forward 30 seconds if you haven't yet read it. Wouldn't it be impossible to use the dictaphone in the murder of Roger Ackroyd as an alibi trick, given the size and sound quality of the equipment at that time? I didn't expect much of a reply, since my letter was, as it were, about finding fault in the trick of the novel. I was surprised to receive a reply within a month or so. And Mr. Pseudo does not say what that reply consisted of, but apparently it was cordial enough that a correspondence blossomed between these two. Section 2, a random letter requesting a meeting. I sent it out in the spring of 1972, the letter, that is. I had been already working for 5 years, and I had saved up some money, so I planned my first solo trip to England. I had sent letters 4 times before and had received replies to all of them without much delay, but this time there was no response. And then he theorizes that perhaps she didn't respond to this last letter because I only wrote one-sidedly about my own circumstances. To be a little more specific, the trip was planned for about a week, and since I was only planning to see the sights in London, I had one blank day in my schedule. Also, I had been sending all my previous letters addressed to Winterbrook House, so if I were to visit Wallingford, it would be an easy day trip from London. And if I could meet Ms. Christie on that day, maybe I could at least get her signature on a book? My dream grew on its own. I was making final preparations for the trip when in mid-July I received the reply that I had given up on. The contents stated that in August she was staying not at Winterbrook House in Wallingford, but at Greenway House in Devon, and included the following statement. And now he is quoting from Agatha Christie herself in her letter to him. If you were considering visiting that part of England, which is very beautiful, though somewhat tourist-ridden as most places by the sea are in summer, I would be very pleased to entertain you for perhaps a day or two, or at any rate for a luncheon, since you have written me such a very charming letter. End quote. And after that, there was the address, phone number, directions from London to Paignton Station, etc. This letter really surprised me. It was an invitation for a young engineer whom she had never met before to stay for a night, so I think it would be strange to not be surprised. At first, I was quite suspicious and worried, thinking whether it wasn't a similar trick to the ones used in her works. If I had known that Ms. Christie in her later years stayed at Greenway House every August, I would not have sent a letter asking to meet her in the first place, since a day trip was impossible. This situation might be a textbook example of how ignorance turned out to be a good thing. Section 3, Ms. Christie's actions on August 5th and 6th. She spent quite some time with me. At that time, Ms. Christie was 82 years old and had to walk with a cane due to a hip fracture she suffered the previous year. First thing that surprised me was the difference between Ms. Christie's appearance then and that in her 60s, which I knew from photographs. I arrived at Greenway around 2 o'clock p.m. in the car of Rosalind, Christie's only daughter, who picked me up from the station. After I put my luggage in the room, I met Ms. Christie and Mr. Mallowan for the first time. They were sitting on the deck chairs next to the front door, and I sat down on the chair between them, and we chatted for about 40 minutes. I was so nervous that I could barely understand them, so I omit further details. After that, I got into a car driven by her husband, Mr. Mallowan, and was taken to nearby places with scenic views, for example, where Dartmoor can be seen. Ms. Christie rode in the back seat with a dog in her arms. After returning to the house, it was tea time, and I chatted with Ms. Christie, Ms. Rosalind, and several women I didn't know. I was able to relax a little during that time. Ms. Christie also talked a lot. It was particularly memorable when she talked about her wax figure in London, explaining, also with hand gestures, the measurements of the shape of the head and the like. Next, there was a short break and then dinner. At the table were Mr. Mallowan, Ms. Christie, Ms. Rosalind, and myself. I was there as if in place of their grandson, so the atmosphere was the same as during a normal dinner. No need to worry about manners, etc., and it was relaxing. I omit the description of food. After dinner, we chatted in the living room next door. It was a reverse pattern. I answered Mr. Mallowan's questions. I had already run out of questions to ask Ms. Christie, so it was very helpful. In the middle of the chat, Mr. Hicks, Rosalind's husband, and Mr. Matthew, Rosalind's only son, 2 years younger than me, came home. Mr. Matthew left after only shaking hands, but Mr. Hicks stayed and became the central figure of the chat. During this chat, Ms. Christie sat in a chair in the corner and seemed to be listening to everything that was being said, but she didn't ask me any questions. The next day, I ate breakfast alone. After that, Mr. Hicks guided me through the Greenway Gardens for over an hour so I could take pictures, and I took pictures of the River Dart, the boathouse, and the Gun Battery Square. A little before 12 o'clock, I said goodbye to Ms. Christie at the entrance, and Mr. Hicks and Mr. Mallowan were also there. Mr. Mallowan drove me to the station afterwards. I remembered that Ms. Christie has long disliked having her photographs taken, so I didn't ask her for a commemorative photo, but then Mr. Hicks said, "Let's take a two-shot with Ms. Christie," and Ms. Christie happily lined up next to me. This was probably the biggest surprise of all. The above is a preface to the actual answer below. Section 4, Answer to the Question. I didn't get to know Ms. Christie through an acquaintance of hers or someone related to the publishing house, like an editor or agent. It started from a fan letter, and for some reason, Ms. Christie recognized me to some extent, and I received the invitation. However, I was a young man of the same generation as Ms. Christie's grandson and a mere computer engineer. Such a person was invited by a great mystery writer who had achieved great success. From the common sense point of view of a Japanese person, I believed that even if we could meet, it would only be for about an hour or so, and it would be Ms. Rosalind or her servant who would take care of me for the rest of the time. In reality, however, this was not the case. The biggest surprise was that Ms. Christie was not pompous towards me, but rather treated even a young Japanese person such as myself in a friendly manner. It was also a great surprise that even though she was over 80 years old, her curiosity for observing people did not seem to diminish, and she spent a lot of time with me. It is possible that I misread the English text of the question, but the last three lines of Section 4 are my answer. Postscript. Perhaps the surprises I felt came from being a young Japanese man, and it would not have been such a surprise to an Englishman. At that time, I had almost no experience even staying overnight in other people's houses. Well, Mr. Sudo, I can assure you that it would have been a surprising experience. I think for anyone of any nationality, that is such a charming story, especially having just been to Greenway myself when I went to Torquay for the International Agatha Christie Festival last year. I could imagine exactly where Mr. Sudo was. Those deck chairs made of canvas are still right outside the front door. They sit in a row and you can sit on them and gaze out on the greenery and the River Dart, which appears through said greenery. It's a lovely spot. I can picture the room where they congregated just after eating in the dining room and had their cozy chat. I can also so easily imagine Mr. Sudo as a character in a fictional Agatha Christie story. The way that he comes down to breakfast and eats it alone. He has Christie's daughter and then Christie's husband driving him between the train station and the country estate. Sure, there were no murders committed during his stay, as far as we know. So we're minus some intrigue there, but this detailed response is dripping with charm. And I'm so grateful to Mr. Sudo for giving me such a detailed answer. I never expected that. And I really feel like I have a greater sense of Christie as a person, and in particular, of the way she conducted herself at her holiday home of Greenway, right up until the end of her life. What a treat. Thank you, Mr. Sudo, for sharing that with me and for allowing me to share it with all of you. Don't touch that dial. We'll be back in a moment with the rest of our episode. We just wanted to take a moment to ask you, our dear listeners, for a favor.
If you haven't already done so, we would very much appreciate it if you take a moment to, you know, give us a rating or a review wherever you're listening to this podcast.
It really helps the podcast out because ratings and reviews make it much easier for other Christie fans such as yourselves to find our podcast.
And the more ratings and reviews we get, the more people we can reach.
It should take you a matter of seconds, and lucky you, we're going to provide you with those seconds right now, so go to it.
Thank you so much. And now, back to our regularly scheduled programming.
So that was in August of 1972. When Christie was just shy of her 82nd birthday. We're going to travel backward in time now to the autumn of 1966, when Agatha Christie and her husband, Max Malamon, went on an extended tour in the United States. Christie was 76 years old at the time. Catherine and I talked about this tour in our Halloween party episode. It was Max who was doing a series of lectures in various university cities. Apparently, Agatha was also invited to do a lecture series, but she declined. And when I was researching that tour for the Halloween party episode, there definitely was no mention of Max and Agatha coming to Los Angeles. But I now know that they did, in fact, come to Los Angeles, thanks to the second story I have to share with you. Now, this one is a live conversation that I was able to record for you all. So you'll be getting this one straight from the horse's mouth. The horse in question is Dr. Ernestine Elster, a much decorated, much published, longtime professor of archaeology at UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles, for the uninitiated. Dr. Elster actually got in touch with me herself after reading the article that was written about me and the All About Agatha podcast by the talented Deborah Netburn of the LA Times. I'll link to that article again in the notes to this episode in case you haven't read it. Please do read it and then subscribe to the LA Times afterward. Support regional journalism, listeners. So Dr. Elster sent me an email that read as follows. Read article in LAT today and thought back to when I met Dame Agatha and Sir Max Malamon! ! Want to hear about it? Shoot an email if interested. E.S. Elster. You can bet I responded to that email right quick. And this interview that I conducted with Dr. Elster is the result. Take a listen.
I had just gone back to UCLA to graduate school in archaeology. I hadn't studied that in my undergraduate years. Mm-hmm. I'd gotten married, had three children. They were growing up, and that's when I went back to school. So,
did you grow up in this area?
No, I grew up in New York until I was 17. Okay. Then my parents, we came out here. My grandmother lived here. And then I graduated high school and went to UCLA. Mm-hmm. And I've never gone back. I mean, I've gone back to New York, but I've lived here ever since.
So you went to UCLA for undergrad?
And for graduate school.
And for graduate school. Oh, wow. So you really didn't go back. Where in New York did you grow up? Just out of curiosity, because I grew up in New York, too.
I grew up first in a little town called Edgemere on Long Island near Far Rockaway.
Oh, okay.
Until I was 10.
Okay.
Then we moved into the Bronx.
Okay.
Which I hated. And then I was 10. And then when I was 17, we came out here.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I grew up in Westchester, but before that, I initially was born in Long Island, and my parents lived on the South Shore in Long Beach, actually. Okay. So not far from the Rockaways at all. And also a nice, lovely beaches as well, actually.
That's right. And there. Wonderful swimming.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Nicer than the Bronx, I guess.
Not the Bronx. Anyway,
So you were out here then in the 60s, basically,
Well, no, because I was born in 1925. I'm quite old.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Congratulations. You are 97?
I'm going to be 97.
Wow.
In another month.
Well, congrats.
Thank you. But, so I came here when I was 17. It was 1943. It was the beginning of the war. The middle of the war.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So, UCLA had a much limited student body, and it had, it had the NROTC, and it had the V-12. So it had sailors, so-called sailors in the uniform in our classes, which we thought was fun anyway. And so I graduated in 4 years later in 47, mm-hmm. and I got married a year later. Everybody got married, you have to understand,
right.
in those years.
Right.
And then I think I began to explore what I was going to do as my youngest child was in school for the full day. And I took a lot of extension classes, and I tried the PTA and everything,
mm-hmm.
and tennis every day, and da 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 da. And then one of my friends, who I had been to school with from 1943 to 47, she stopped by and said, "I am in graduate school, and you have to try it." She said, "You will find a door you never knew was there. You'll open the door, and inside, there'll be magic." And I thought, that'll never happen. But anyway, I did go back to UCLA. I thought I'd get my teaching credential, which I hadn't. You have to do practice teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But along the way, along campus, I met a man who had been one of the, organizers of an extension class. And the extension class was very fascinating. It was called Land and Life in Baja California.
Uh-huh.
And it had a different lecture every Monday. And one would be, there was a historian, there was a ethnographer, there was a geographer, and an archaeologist. And then they had a little field trip to Baja California. And this is a long time ago, before Cabo San Lucas was anything like it was. And there wasn't even a road from La Paz to Cabo San Lucas.
Wow.
But at any rate, I convinced my husband that we would go with our three sons, which we did. And it was really a fascinating trip. And there were a couple of archaeologists who were on this field trip. And wherever we went around La Paz, it seemed to me that they saw more than I had any idea even existed, like shell middens, and this is a 17th century building because of the square nails or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what a way to see the world. And I knew I wanted to see the world.
Yeah, to see the layers to things, yeah.
At any rate, the man who had organized this extension was in the Department of History, and I happened to bump into him on the sidewalk at UCLA, and he said, "Since you enjoyed the archaeologist in La Paz, there's an archaeologist on campus now. She's a woman, and she teaches European archaeology."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Really? When is she teaching?" And he said, "Tuesdays and Thursdays, exactly when you're here." "Do you think I could take her class?" said I. "Well," he said, "I think you'd be an auditor." So indeed, I went in there. She said, "Sit down." And so it really began, and it was, I just absolutely was captivated.
And that was in the 50s then?
It was in the 60s.
That was in the 60s.
I think about 1965 or 66, I became her graduate student.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway, how does this bring us to art? That brings us to archaeology.
Yes.
So one of our friends had been involved in archaeology, and he, I think, was the president of the AIA Society, And he said to us, you know, there's a very well-known archaeologist coming to the United States, to Los Angeles, and his name is Max Mallowan, and he's married to Agatha Christie, and I'm going to have a cocktail party. Joanne and I are having a cocktail party, mm-hmm. and so you two were invited, and we went, mm-hmm. and that's how it happened.
Because they were doing, they did, and they came in the mid-60s to do,
they
had a big tour of the
All
United
over.
States.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's right.
That's right. That's right.
And so she, so this was, their house was in Beverly Hills, mm-hmm. and you entered the living room, and the hostess, Joanne, was standing near the couch, and Agatha was sitting on the couch, and she was a very large woman, mm-hmm. and she didn't bother about fancy outfits. She practically always appeared in black, I understand, but she looked very comfortable on the couch, mm-hmm. and he was in the dining room where our host had set up a bar, so we went in and said hello to him, and he was very dapper, fine-looking man,
yes.
nice outfit, nice tweeds, and then I went back into the living room. Sandy stayed in the dining room, and my hostess said, would you like to meet Agatha Christie? And I said, yes, I've been thinking about meeting her. I've heard so much about her and what she once said. And Joanne said, then stay here, stay, just because she's talking to somebody else, then I'll introduce you.
Mm-hmm.
And she introduced me, and I sort of perched on the end of the couch and talked to her and said to her, Lady Mallowan, I think I said, or maybe I said, Miss Christie, I don't know what I said. I've been quoting you, and I wanted to tell you that every time I quote you, I always get such positive response. Well, my dear, she said, what have you been saying? And she's nibbling, and she had a drink of wine, and she's nibbling peanuts. She's very, very relaxed, very charming.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I've been saying that when the reporters asked you about marrying Sir Max, and how is it that you, a famous writer, decided to marry an archaeologist, somebody in another field altogether. And she said, and then I said that you said,
mm-hmm.
well, remember now, in the world of archaeology, the older you grow, the more precious you become. And she looked at me and she said, how charming that is, but I never said it. At which point I couldn't think of another thing to say except, oh, thank you. And I got up and left. And she just, you know, she just was as comfortable as could be. But the funny thing is that whenever you would meet anybody who knew Max Mallowan, who knew her too, people who worked in Syria, they would always say the same thing. So whether she said it or didn't say it, we'll never know. But I thought but that was my story.
That's so fun. And then I think there are so many stories of people telling Agatha Christie that, because it was it still is to this day.
If you Google it, it's
you know, a quote that Agatha Christie said. And at this point, it's kind of coming back around where people are thinking, maybe she did say that actually. And then she just decided, maybe I don't want to be affiliated with that quote. That's so wonderful. I love that when I think if you met her in archaeology circles where she wasn't the center of attention,
mm-hmm.
she could be very relaxed and charming, and she didn't like being the center of
attention. She was completely relaxed.
Yeah.
The fact that I sat there and was so anxious didn't bother her at all.
Yeah.
She would have continued to talk to me if I hadn't gotten so startled by what she said.
So flustered.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because at that point, I mean, she was, you know, this is when she's at the height of her career,
oh,
right?
Question.
She was,
no question.
You know, a superstar. But that's so great. Oh, I love that you met her. And in Los Angeles, too. I can't believe it was here in Beverly Hills. When you contacted me, I did not think that the story would be taking place here, but that's right. Because they went all over on that trip. They went to Texas and everywhere.
He was very highly respected.
Yes.
As an archaeologist. And he had a lot to say because he was working in that part of the world where there was so much going on. You couldn't put a shovel in the ground without
yes.
finding something.
Yeah.
And he'd worked at some very well-known sites.
Yeah. Nimrud, I think, was...
Nimrud.
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 Mm-hmm.
And others, too.
Sure, sure.
Other sites as well.
Yeah.
So it was... And then she wrote this, I forgot the name of the book in which she wrote about the excavation. I can't remember the
Murder
title.
In Mesopotamia takes place.
That was one. There was another one, wasn't there? Two of them. But anyway.
There are a couple, yeah. Yeah, she was, because she went there to that area so often and did a lot of her writing there, too.
Which is so interesting because, you know, on site in an area such as that, it's not all that creature comfortable.
Right.
Really. Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter what it looks like on television, no matter what the tents look like. And
yeah.
Somebody bringing you tea to your tent. It's not like where you're living at home with your own. I mean, because my work in Greece and I've worked in several places, but in Greece, the first one, we didn't have running water.
Oh wow!
And we didn't have a regular Western toilet at all.
Oh boy!
And we would go to the end of the street and fill up our buckets and fill the tub. We had a tub. We had a toilet, but nothing was connected.
Oh, my God. So that was really like living 100 years ago.
Yeah, but it didn't seem like that. We weren't thinking that way because it was so exciting to be there.
First of all, I think we all wish we could be as sharp as Dr. Elster in our mid heading into late 90s. What an opportunity it was to be able to sit down with her and hear her story about meeting Agatha Christie, but also just hear her own story, which I found absolutely fascinating. I should add, she invited me into her home. We were having that conversation at her dining room table, and I'm just so grateful to have been able to meet her. Don't you get the sense that she and Agatha Christie would have really hit it off if she hadn't run away from that couch where she was perched, misquoting Agatha Christie? Did you know where that story was going before she got there? I sure did. I could see that coming. And yet I was enchanted by it all the same. I especially love the way she emphasized how at ease Christie was and how Christie would have happily gone on talking to her if she hadn't run away. Okay, we are going to go back in time a little further for our third and final story. It is now the evening of the 13th of September, 1957, just 2 days before Agatha Christie turns 67 years old. If saying 67 years young didn't make me want to vomit, I would say it, since it's nice to think about how many more good years and good books Agatha Christie had ahead of her in 1957. So now, this is a story I initially heard firsthand over a dinner table in a crowded restaurant at the International Agatha Christie Festival in Torquay last year. Norman Holm is a longtime attendee of the festival, and in addition to being a lovely man, he is a lifelong Agatha Christie fan. Coincidence? I think not. I loved Norman's story of meeting Agatha Christie in person so much that I got in touch with him to ask him if he would be willing to share it. And generous man that he is, he agreed immediately to do so. Norman had every intention of recording himself telling the story. Unfortunately, some health difficulties he was having affected his speech, and he decided that it would be best if he wrote the story down and I read it out on his behalf. So here goes. Hello, I am Norman Holm. I live in London and am a lifelong Agatha Christie fan. I have some difficulty speaking clearly at present, so I've written here what I should like to tell you. I met Agatha Christie twice. The first time was truly memorable. As a teenager, I went to see The Mousetrap on the 13th of September in 1957, the night the play broke the record and became the longest-running straight play in the history of the British theater. This was at the Ambassador's Theater, where the play had opened 5 years earlier. The Ambassador's Theater has just the stalls and a single circle. Agatha Christie was seated in the front row of the circle with a couple of companions. The interval came, and they stayed where they were, the remainder of the audience having gone up to the bar. I walked down the side aisle to the front of the circle and stood there, holding the program. After a few moments, Agatha looked across to me and smiled, enough of a gesture to indicate that I might walk over to her. I did so, and she signed my program. I asked her whether we could expect a Christie at Christmas in a few months' time. Agatha looked at me, a twinkle in her eye, and said, "I think we'll have to wait and see, won't we?" The program Agatha signed was a special one, with a photograph of her on the front, above a few lines about this being an historic occasion, and extending warm and affectionate greetings to Mrs. Agatha Christie. It seemed typical of her that she didn't sign quickly on the photograph, but carefully, in the space between the photograph and the printed tribute underneath. My second meeting with Agatha Christie was some 3 years later, and one I was recently surprised to see in my diary for the 23rd of March 1960, when her play Go Back for Murder opened at the Duchess Theatre in London. The play, which I described as very disappointing, was based on the Christie novel Five Little Pigs. Particularly because this was the first night, some of us went to the stage door afterwards to greet the author and cast members. Agatha came out, and I noted in my diary that I chatted with her. I have no note of what we said, but there it is. Further evidence, if any were needed, that Agatha had time for her fans and a nice rapport with young people with whom she could feel comfortable and be herself. What a lovely anecdote from Mr. Holm. Two anecdotes, in fact. Thank you so much for that. Mr. Holm was also generous enough to send me a screenshot of that program that Agatha Christie signed, and I have posted that screenshot on the podcast's social media pages at All About the Dame on Twitter and at All About Agatha on Instagram. So check that out if you would like. For the record, there was a Christie for Christmas in 1957. It was $4.50 from Paddington, not too shabby. I also love the fact that Mr. Holm is obviously an unabashed enthusiast of all things Agatha Christie, but that doesn't mean he can't be critical. He did not like Go Back for Murder, which I have to admit, I have certainly not seen, but not even read. I'll probably have to cover that at some point on the podcast's Patreon account. The last thing I just want to say is that his memory of meeting Agatha Christie during the interval of The Mousetrap very much reminded me of the feature film See How They Run, which came out last year. That was set in 1953 on the 100th performance of The Mousetrap. Norman's brush with Christie happened in 1957, but close enough. And it makes me very curious to find out what he made of that movie. So I will have to ask him that at the next International Agatha Christie Festival this coming September. I mean, let's be real for a second. We don't need our authors to be nice people, especially our deceased authors. And that's a good thing because many, many, many of them were not nice people. And I'm not going to say that Agatha Christie was an angel. She was a human, and she is as unknowable to me and to you as every other human is who you or I haven't met. And yet, perhaps we are a little closer to having met Agatha Christie at the end of this episode. And that is why I am so thrilled by the way Yasuo Sudo and Ernestine Elster and Norman Holm all highlighted Agatha Christie's kindness and warmth. I think that's really significant, and it makes me very, very happy. And to go back to where I started at the beginning of this episode, with that exercise of asking yourself where you would go if you had a time machine and why, I find myself remarking here from my middle-aged adulthood on the childish innocence of wishing to go back to the mid-Victorian period of 1848 or the original Globe Theater in Shakespeare's day. That is the answer of someone who hasn't experienced a lot of personal loss in their life. An honest answer from me now would be that if I could go back in time, I would love to see my grandmother, who passed away over 10 years ago. In particular, I'd love to see her when she was young and working in her early 20s in a hospital in England during the Second World War. I mentioned this on a recent Patreon episode, actually. It came out just over a month ago, in which I discussed Christiana Brand's Green for Danger, fabulous mystery. That novel is set in the midst of the Second World War in a military hospital. And I talked about how my grandmother and her twin sister worked as nurses together and how, incredibly, my great aunt was still with us while I was recording that episode at the magnificent age of 104. Sadly, my great aunt passed away soon after this episode aired. Another loss. I, of course, also find myself thinking about my beloved former partner on this very podcast, Catherine Brobeck. So here's another answer. If I could go back in time to anywhere, I'd go back to the moment I met Catherine in 2008, and I'd tell her to check up on her liver functions, make sure she was going to the doctor regularly. That's not a very fun answer, but these are the sorts of fantasies we start having when we've lived on this earth long enough to experience the loss that touches all of us eventually, as Agatha Christie herself no doubt understood. And yet, I don't want to be a total downer here. Let's not end this joyous episode in such a glum manner. I will have you know that I have gone to the Globe Theater in London. It's the reconstituted Globe, of course. And while I didn't see Measure for Measure or The Winter's Tale there, I saw Mark Rylance in Antony and Cleopatra playing the role of Cleopatra. He was exquisite. That is a wonderful memory of mine. I also managed to create my own Crystal Palace in my mystery novel, which will be published in a little less than a year now. Is that a plug? It's kind of too early for a plug. If you end up reading my mystery and you remember this conversation, I hope you'll smile when you get to my version of the Crystal Palace. And even though none of us will ever meet Agatha Christie, I hope this episode brought you a little closer to her. Because reading and listening to these stories myself certainly had that effect on me. And I just want to thank Mr. Sudo, Dr. Elster, and Mr. Holm once again for sharing their experiences. It's greatly, greatly appreciated. Believe it or not, we are getting close to 50 years from the death of Agatha Christie, which means that these stories are few and far between and getting increasingly fewer and farther. So I would just say, as I close out this episode, that if anyone out there has another story of meeting Agatha Christie IRL, or knows of someone else who does, please let me know. You can email me at allaboutthedame@gmail.com or find me on the podcast's Twitter account at allaboutthedame or over on Instagram at allaboutagatha. The podcast's Patreon page is over at www.patreon.com, /allaboutagatha. I've also included a link in the notes to this episode. For my next episode, I will be interviewing a debut mystery author. Her name is Kitty Murphy, and she has written Death in Heels, which is the first in a series called the Dublin Drag Mysteries. I am so excited to talk about this book with Kitty and share it with you. It was published on January 1st of this year, 2023, so it is available for you to purchase and read if you would like to do so in advance of the episode. And if you have a little bit of extra time, please give the podcast a rating and or a review wherever you are listening to it. It means a lot to me. And I'll see you next time. Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.